two different countries.
Yeah.
And the problem was I was too old to get a transplant back to England, according to my doctors. So, back then or now? Well, let's go back.
10 years.
It was 04. But I was 10 years, so I was 67.
That's young. I mean, that's still kind of young now. I mean, they don't turn.
Well, I don't know. They get
there's no official age limit. You know, there really isn't. Just age limit for transplant. Yeah. Certainly, you know, the older you are, the higher you have risk factors.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, there's certainly, I've seen 78-year-old transplant. It's not really common occurrence. You know, you have to be in excellent shape. Then you have to be willing to kind of
well, I don't know whether I would have went that route or not. You know, we talked about it. She, either my medical history or age was a factor.
It should be the factor. It has to be
right.
But if you look, if, you know, in reading that book, that ACS book, I didn't get that book, I had one that I was surprised to get it.
Yep.
It did when I was reading it, because I was like, oh my gosh, they stopped at 65 or 60. I think that was in that book, it says 60 or above, they didn't want you. And I was like, I'm only 2 years away. I'm going to hurt to get this transplant
down
the chair. That's not
awesome. Transplant has gotten a lot better. The technology behind transplants and the reduced intensity transplant that we have that really focus more on modulating your immune system, you know, really harnessing the graft versus resistance.
Because some people, when they get them, it's like starting all over because you've got that transplant, which is the makeup of that person, whatever immune system they had, whatever history they had.
In some situations, it's very much exchanging one disease for another.
I was, you know, I don't know if you recall, but Robin Roberts had that transplant. I was really disappointed because they did an hour and a half to 2 hour program, and it was all on her. They had a chance and an opportunity to make the people aware of MDS, the problems with it, the need for research, and a lot of other things. They didn't take 1 minute to talk about that.
Really?
It was all about her. And I wrote her a letter. I wrote her a really nasty letter. And,
who did you write it to? I'm just curious.
I wrote it to the station.
The station?
Yeah. Yeah. I wish, you know, 200 people would have written a letter to the station. Yeah. I mean, I didn't care about good for her. She got one, but she spent 5 minutes on that. And then spend another hour talking about MDS, which is unknown to 200 million people.
Right.
And they need to know about it like they do other diseases. You know? Anyway, it just irritated me. And I sat down at my computer and told them what I thought of it.
And that's why, you know, breast cancer is such a, you know, everyone sees the, you know, everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of patient advocacy, really.
But the thing is, breast cancer is very simple. I mean, you cut it out, it's a hard tumor. It's solid. And whereas the MDS is a chronic cancer, people don't understand the concept of chronic and the mass is the individual cancer. So it's
blood cancers are very difficult to just kind of explain to friends and family members and just to have an understanding because you're right, it's very different than solid tumors, which, you know, it's in breast and there's lymph nodes, but it's liver and bones, it's breast. You can't stage MDS really, or leukemia is very well because you have them, right? You have them, or you don't, and they're chronic. You're right, MDS is not, as we know it now, a curable disease unless we have terrible, unless transplant. Transplant is the only curative treatment for MDS at this time. So everything else is managed.
Blood tests
becomes a chronic disease.
I'm just gonna, it's 9 o'clock, so it's that time of the day. I just want to introduce you guys to Dr. Gennardo. I'll let her introduce herself in a minute. It's just, you guys are familiar with this place. I am from New Jersey. My name is Jake Shirey. I'm a nurse practitioner. I work with my second floor cancer center. I'm going to do the second half of just the meeting and talking with you guys. Deborah and Audrey are from the Foundation. Just feel free to reach out to them for any more information that you have or questions of how to connect. And the bathrooms are on this side, phones, or what, put them on vibrate if you can. This is a very informal, kind of like a your session day.
Yeah, I would love this. Come up.
We are here because you guys, wanted, number one, to have us come over and speak with you about concerns, talks, or ideas, or how to make MPS be more of
understandable.
Easy, kind of this is for you. So whatever questions or concerns, or just tell us your story, whatever you want to do today, it's up to you.
It's such a small group. Would it be helpful to go around and just introduce and say, if you guys feel comfortable, if not, you can just ask, but say who you are and why you want to be here. So
then we get to know you too.
Yeah.
Well, I'm Richard.
You started. Yeah.
And I was diagnosed in 04, so I've been living with it for 10 years now. The first 8 years, I was with a well-known Houston hematologist, and my treatment basically was with a shot called Aranus, and it was something that stimulates the bone marrow in producing additional red blood cells. And what happened to me over the first 8 years is the frequency of me going to Methodist Hospital to receive the shot. You couldn't get them in the doctor's office because Medicare forces you to go to the hospital rather than a doctor's office, okay? So the frequency increased as well as the dosage. So it got to the point where I was going every 2 weeks at a maximum dosage. And at that point...
And still needing transfusions?
Pardon?
Were you needing red cell transfusions also?
No, this was off campus. And at that point, the hematologist mentioned chemo. And because I'd been here before for another situation, I looked up MD Anderson and I did an analysis of all of the MDS doctors that were practicing here.
And I wasn't here by chance.
And I researched. Well, I researched Dr. Garcia Manero.
Yes.
And I wrote him a 2-page letter telling him why I needed to come over here and see him personally.
Okay.
So he accepted that and we got together and talked. So I've been his patient for 2 years now.
What did you do for a living?
I'm retired.
What did you do?
I was in the oil industry.
Okay. As
the oil service sector, not a Shell or Exxon, but a service company. Baker Hughes is here in Houston.
Okay.
So we provide the tools and the means of getting the oil out of the ground. So I was in manufacturing, marketing, finance, and corporate assignments, so I was in all facets of the business. And I trained people around the world.
Are you still able to work?
Oh yeah, well, I don't. After 30 years with Baker, I was a consultant for 10 years. And then I decided that was enough. So I've been retired now for, I guess 15 years. Yeah, it's nice. My wife works part time. She's a realtor. She's been a realtor for 35 years. And that subsidizes our living in addition to Social Security and retirement. So that enables us to do, you know, the things that we used to do when we both worked.
I do want to tell you that this is being recorded for the purpose of, one, documenting and validating that there is a need for MDS awareness, number one, and also to, we share, we do these patient forums all around the country, and we get all different ideas and thoughts and things from patients and caregivers, and we like to collect those tidbits and put them on file and then and kind of develop a kind of presentation or for, whether it be for patients or other organizations. So I hope that's okay with you guys. I do want to tell you that. It's a disclosure information, just for reference, okay? It's nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to make one more comment.
Yes, sir.
If you don't have all of their emails, you should, because I filled out those surveys that you always send out. And that's got a lot of interesting and vital information, you know, time-wise.
I think it's Deborah, yeah. Deborah, okay. And Andre, I believe.
For those who wanted to share.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Judy Wiggins, and I am, I guess, the caregiver for my husband as a patient. He was diagnosed last October, and he has been on the dazzle since then. He is our doctor's star patient on the dazzle. He has responded to it extremely well. He had one blood transfusion right after he was diagnosed in October, and he's been doing just really, really well. I call him my cat in my lives because he's had 5 stents, he's got a stomach aneurysm, a knee replacement, 2 knee replacements, a hip replacement, he's had lung cancer, heart blood, he has COPD, emphysema, so he's my cat. And somehow he's doing well on this, the dad's doing very, very well. He just got out of hospital this past Tuesday because he had pneumonia. So that's the biggest thing that, you know, no matter how many times you wash your hands or how many kids you avoid, you still wind up, you know, more susceptible to that. And he was hoping to come today, but having just gotten out of hospital, he just decided that he's strength to find him. He's infected since I'm with Sasha, which he says he has a good, of course, but Vanessa is just wonderful. He asked his doctor, his oncologist, how long can I keep going on? He says, as long as it works.
That's right.
And so it's working. So we keep our fingers crossed and see how long it works.
That's, you know, that, and that's a very difficult kind of concept, I think, for patients and family members, is that we don't stop the Vidaza or the Dacogen, which is the kind of sister drug. If it's working, it becomes your, you know, and we're just explaining it to a chronic disease, you know, it becomes your insulin, you know, for your diabetes. It keeps going because we know that when we stop it, almost invariably, within a couple of months, the disease will come back. So it's not curing, but it's, you know, teaching the bone marrow to make the cells correctly again. So it's a modulation process that keeps going.
He was in the hospital this past week. His pulmonary doctor said to him, well, I'm going to send you home with your antibiotic, but you're going to have to be off the mask for 3 weeks. And he just went crazy. And he kept waiting to see what, you know, the hematologist, the oncologist, and so he could talk to him. And, because the pulmonary doctor, his field says, well, you know, if I give an antibiotic, it's, and you're taking the Vanessa is going to counteract what I'm trying to do to cure that. And his oncologist said, no, we're going to start you back up one day. Just 7 days on, 21 days off.
And so what a lot of people who are not involved in blood cancers don't realize is that Vidaza and Dacogen aren't really intensive chemotherapy agents that drop their count. So a lot of physicians are thinking, you know, I'm going to start chemotherapy, it's going to, you know, drop his immune system, the pneumonia is going to come back. And in some patients that happens the first couple of cycles, but other patients are, you know,
this is up.
So there's no real reason.
This way. Blood cells and red blood cells every time you do the testing.
Good for him.
His are up.
Here.
So that was what Dr. Tolman said. No, he said, once, if you were not to take the Vanessa, we could never get you back to that level. So he said, it would be really difficult to see if we could get you back to that level. So I'm just kind of here to, on his behalf and on my behalf, as a caregiver.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Keith Collins with Diplomat Specialty Pharmacy, and I've only been with the company a few months, and I was coming to learn about the disease, and little did I know my father-in-law was diagnosed with MDS a little over a year ago.
Oh, wow.
And from my wife is a pharmacist, and his wife take very close care of him. Of course, he lives in Michigan. But from what I understand, the Aramis is what he's taking, and he only gets that shot once a month if he needs it.
Yep.
And he doesn't always need it. So it seems to be working very well for him so far, and he feels much better since he started therapy, but it hasn't been that long. He's about 87 and kind of stubborn. He's been through liver cancer, heart disease, so many surgeries. I can't recall each one. It could have been very fatal, and he's bounced back with flying colors, just like he bounced back again. So he's quite an envious man. And I really have twofold interest in this disease, knowing that the family members diagnosed with it, and how our business might be able to be beneficial in the future. So I'm just glad to be here.
Perfect. And I'll make a comment based on what you said. So when we talk about MDS, you know, the kind of spiel I give, you know, when I'm seeing a patient for the first time, is kind of, what is MDS? MDS is, it's a cancer of the bone marrow, right? And your bone marrow is in charge of making kind of three things, right? It's in charge of making your red cells, which is what circulates your oxygen, gives you energy. It's in charge of your platelets, which is what keeps you from bleeding. You know, so people with MDS often have low platelets, a low hemoglobin, and then your white cells, which is your immune system, right? So that's, you know, that's what your bone marrow is in charge of, and so that's what is affected in people who have MDS. Why do people get MDS? Sometimes it just happens. You know, it's as you are older and as your bone marrow has been in charge of making all these cells for a lifetime, you know, your bone marrow can just get tired, really, and it can stop making cells the right way. MDS dysplasia just means abnormal looking. So it means, you know, you're making funny looking cells. You know, this, you're making them. You're making the red cells and the platelets and the white cells, but they're just not functioning the right way out of the bone marrow. Sometimes they get stuck in the bone marrow and don't circulate as well as in the circulation. So that's why, you know, the counts are lower in the peripheral blood, even though you have what's called a hypercellular marrow. You know, you've got too many cells in the bone marrow, but they're not working the way they should, and they're not being released. And so some people get MDS as a consequence of a lifetime in exposure. You know, some people have had a lot of benzenes or certain occupational exposures. We see a higher risk in airline pilots who've been exposed to a lot of radiation. Sometimes it's chemotherapy for other cancers. You mentioned liver, so I don't know what he was treated with, but a lot of times the chemotherapy that you give for other diseases, we know it affects the bone marrow because the counts drop after chemotherapy, right? So it's affecting the bone marrow and it's making it, you know, more damaged, really, so that decades later, now that we've done a good job at treating the primary cancer, we're starting to have secondary therapy-related myelodysplastic syndromes. When we have a lower risk MDS, where, you know, you have sometimes an isolated low blood count, low red cell count, the growth factors, Procrit or Aramis, sometimes do very good. It's all you need initially, and it just improves the counts enough that you're not needing transfusions. And so that's a very effective strategy in some people with lower risk MDS. Not so effective in higher risk MDS. So some of you might have a more high risk phenotype where that wasn't offered to you, and it's, there's a reason. There's a population that it's very appropriate for, and then there's a population itself.
Good morning, I'm Shannon Cochran, Cell Chief. I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here and listen to your stories and your experiences. It really helps me learn from you guys, but I really need that from a very genuine place. I have not had any personal experience with MDS as far as from a family perspective, but I have had friends who have been diagnosed with MDS, or a friend's mother was misdiagnosed, and this was 10 years ago, and we didn't have a lot of therapies that we have today now. My family hasn't tested other forms of cancer, so I'm always just, I feel so, nice to come and listen to your experiences so that I know what really matters, and so I realistically know what is important. That makes any sense to discuss with nurses, pharmacists, or maybe my healthcare providers that need to know more information about a product that we been selling Jeep over to Methodist.
Yeah.
Salty biotech, it's a pharmaceutical company.
It's a biotech. They're the ones that actually made the ACE society. My Revlimid.
Yes.
So they're...
For any of you who get very irritated with the Revlimid monthly,
we do have a new online system now, which hopefully you guys are able to do your patient surveys online now. So that should hopefully help.
That's very helpful. No, it is. It's made a huge difference because it's quite problematic to find the patient, where they are, and yeah, thank you. Much appreciated.
And does anybody know why you have to go through this grueling process?
So Revlimid is lenalidomide, which is another appropriate agent for a subset of MDS patients, which tends to be people with an isolated chromosome change that's called a deletion 5q. And so there is a cohort of MDS patients who have an isolated 5q deletion. They tend to have a very low red cell count, but sustained kind of platelet count and white cell count. And so there's a pill called lenalidomide or Revlimid that is very effective for that subtype of MDS. So that's what we're talking about. But it requires a lot of back and forth getting approval for it because I'm going to steal your thunder. It is a second generation of thalidomide. Thalidomide being the drug that many of you may remember called the liver baby syndrome when pregnant women took it for nausea. And so it's very carefully distributed to people of any age, but in particular, patients of childbearing potential, and so there's a lot of checks and balances and then distribution of that drug.
Thank you for coming.
Good morning. My name is Rosemary Catallo. I'm a librarian in the Learning Center here at MD Anderson. And actually, I wasn't supposed to be here today. I came in to catch up on some work, and I was looking at my email, and I thought, oh my God, well, how did I miss this patient conference? And I like to come to these patient conferences because I always like to keep updated with what's going on in that particular disease. And also because, like Shannon, I realize that a person learns, once you know the basics of the disease and you keep up, someone who really wants to know the disease, wants to know the impacts on family, caregivers, how to deal with side effects, how people deal with the chronic disease. In order to really get a feel for that, you always need to be in contact with the patients and the caregivers. So that's why I like to come to these. I really wasn't on your list. But I figured since I was downstairs, I would come up and I'd find out as much as I could. But the Learning Center is actually a consumer health library here at MD Anderson. A lot of our patients who have been coming here for years don't know about us. We are currently located on the fourth floor, across from the A elevators. I don't know how many of you are MD Anderson patients, but what we do is we provide people information, we do database searches, so if you wanted to come in and you wanted like the most recent paper that Dr. Monroe has given out for you, we put it up for you. A lot of times docs will say, well, if you want to find out more about this, go look up the results of this trial. So, and then we also provide people supporting information, so I just want you to know about that.
What's it called again?
You don't know either. It's called the Learning Center, as opposed to there's a patient family library, right. It's like a public library.
Right.
Yeah, that's where people get their leisure reading because people don't always want to read about diseases when they come here. And there's also another Learning Center in the Mays Clinic. But we tend to focus on MDS and the blood cancers because actually those clinics, that clinic is located here in the main building. And then the Mays Learning Center focuses on the centers that are located in Mays Clinic, breast, gen, and genitourinary cancers. But please do come by. We're open Monday through Friday, 9 to 4, and we're happy to help you in whatever way we can.
That's great. Do you have a contact phone number or an email for them to refer back? Maybe you can give it to me during lunch hours?
Actually, we also have a e-reference service, and people can actually can send them information. But after...
Why don't I just put it up and people can write it down? Right? That would be easy. We'll add it to the end, which is provide contact information is 2. Alright.
Okay, it's, I'm trying to think of our reference service. It's www.asktlcstaff@mdanderson.org.
Ask TLC staff
at mdanderson.org. And could you just put a phone number down there for our main library?
Yeah.
713-745-8063. And that's the number of the library here in the main building.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Jerry. I mean, it's her story to tell, but a couple of things I just want to comment. I appreciate your definition of MDS a little while ago, because I'm one of those that you give me things to read, and I would read them, and you know, just too much, and it always got into percentages, and I didn't want to read percentages, so I just put the book away, because they're not the odds necessarily to read are not that great. So I let her just...
Which is actually why I don't really want to go through my presentation. Right. So I like this better because it's, you know, there's an understanding of the disease and there's, you know, and so in some people it's very helpful to know all the numbers and I'm happy to give that to patients who are interested, but some people don't really want to know that. And again, remember that odds are population-based. You know, it's looking at thousands of patients and saying what we think, you know, making broad generalizations, but every patient is very different. So, you know, who's to say that you're going to be that person? So I very much agree.
Right. And then the other thing is, in this discussion, the one thing is, you know, being, you know, I consider myself a caregiver because I'm not that. But anyway, through the year since she's been diagnosed, one of the issues, you know, we obviously, MD Anderson, we're from Houston, so it was like, this is where we're going to go, because she was a Methodist, was diagnosed. But so we have two premier doctors on the MDS side and on the transplant side. But so much discussion about when to go, when not to go. It was very stressful watching BLAS versus cytogenics. And I'm talking like I know what I'm talking about. But the point is, that was probably one of the more stressful and difficult times in the last year.
Yep.
Anyway, that's just, you know, if the discussion goes forward. But I'll let this, you know, she's the one who has the story to tell.
Okay, so I'm Gail Nellen, and I'm a patient in the Ken. I was diagnosed on September 6th, a year ago, with MDS. But lo and behold, I was probably had MDS for 3 years before that, because I was seeing a hematologist in the med center, as a matter of fact, for what appeared to be a low platelet count. And he had diagnosed me with idiopathic thrombocytopenia. And that just means a low platelet count. And the way he described it, I never remember being frightened or afraid that it was going to be cancer or da da da. And he had been treating me with Promacta, which was supposed to stimulate. So
platelet growth factors. So you learn that Aranesper Procrit, which is a red cell growth factor, it's platelet.
So yeah, so it was stimulating my platelets. And so as long as, I mean, he gave the option, he highly recommended that I had a spleen removed, my spleen removed. And I said, well, you know, do I have to? And he said, well, there's a medication. And he did a bone marrow biopsy like at the beginning of that period, but he never redid the biopsy. But anyway,
did the Promacta work? Did it
change? So it was stimulating it. I mean, it wasn't like, it was in the 80,000 range or 75,000, so it was probably okay. I mean, he said, this is fine, you know, don't worry about it. It's supposed to be 150,000, right?
Yep.
150 plus. So, anyway, so it was doing the thing, and I wasn't feeling bad at all. I didn't really have any symptoms. So we were just, I just kind of was plugging along, and a lot of times I was like, do I really have to take this medicine? It's so expensive. And, you know, so then finally I saw him like in April of that year, and he mentioned this splenectomy. And I was like, and I left there and I told him, well, I just want to really consider that. So I left there thinking, you know, and I really should get a second opinion before I have surgery. I just don't have surgeries without getting second opinions. So that was when I went to another doctor and then this another hematologist, and she looked at my blood work and she had to get, she wanted me to give her all the background information. And she was the one who said, you know, I'm really concerned about your white count now, not just your, you know, and when you saw the doctor back in April, your white count, this, by then it's August, my white count was getting low, real low too. So then she was the one who did another bone marrow biopsy and she diagnosed the MDS. Lo and behold, if, looking back, I went back to the first bone marrow biopsy, which I never received a written copy of. He just told me over the phone it looked fine, is what I remember. But when I looked back at that biopsy, it said, under the diagnosis, it said indicative of MDS. But I was never told that I had MDS all along. At that point, it was probably a low-risk MDS, I'm assuming.
Something.
That's only one factor was being affected. There were no chromosomal issues. But by the time that they did the MDS that second time in 2013, there were no chromosomal issues, but my platelet count was down to like 12%.
Okay.
And I mean, my
blast percentage
was 12%. So in that short amount of time, I had, well, short amount meaning, you know, 3 years is the MDS, I guess that could be a long one. But, when I got that diagnosis, I researched and found Dr. Garcia Manero's name, so that's how I ended up here, because I thought I wanted to get a second. Now I had two opinions, one being that I didn't have MDS, another one saying I did have MDS, so I needed to get somebody else confirming that I do have MDS and what their opinion would be, and that was Dr. Garcia Manero, because he was here close, and he had done so much research on it. And anyway, that's where I stayed. And by then, when he did his initial, when we did the initial, because they want to do another bone marrow biopsy here if they pre-diagnose you. So, and that was just maybe 3 weeks later, it was already showing a chromosomal issue. I don't know, which puts me at a higher risk of MDS, which meant I cut off a year and a half of life expectancy. So it was really concerning just the diagnosis that at that point. But they all geared me towards having a stem cell transplant because of my age and the high risk factor. So that's where I went to and had my stem cell. I had pre-chemo of Vidaza for about 5 months. That's right, 5 cycles of it. And then I went into the, had my stem cell transplant. Now I'm 5.5 months, 5 months and 26 days, right?
Oh, that's
post-transplant. And you know, I'm feeling great. I'm feeling great. And I haven't had any blood products since I left the hospital. I haven't had, you know, and the doctors are all very happy with the outcome. But Dr. Garcia Manero, the first doctor at the other hospital in the medical center, had said, you know, that he, candidate for a stem cell transplant. I was 56 years old at the time. But and she said the only, and that was her cure, the only chance of cure. But when I got to Dr. Garcia Manero, he was like, well, I don't like to use that word cure with MDS. He says, I feel like it always comes back. It's just the fact that you're so young, he said, it could likely come back in your life. So, anyway, so he didn't use the word cure, whereas other places I was hearing and find out that the stem cell transplant was being sure. And so that might be a different philosophy. Also, if you read Robin Roberts, they say cure, you know, if you have that stem cell transplant. And so I think that's
a tricky word. Yeah.
It's a tricky word because I always, and even my stem cell doctors was saying cure. So there was a difference. One of the big
I use cure.
Yeah,
I'm
and
good with that.
It's really hard to explain to people who don't have a lot of understanding if you don't use that word remission or cure, because people just never really understand, well, how am I, you know, how do I relate? It's challenging.
Yeah. Well, and so I do like to get every time I ask somebody or hear that come out of the doctor's mouth, I'll say, okay, what do you mean a cure?
And then they probably come in hard.
Just for your sake, one of the very big challenges is in that 5-month period where I was going through chemo and going through to try to get my blast down. That was a big, because I tend to delve into the facts and I like to know, go to the literature all the weekend. I'm saying, can you stop doing that? It's just making you depressed. But the chromosomal issue I had was trisomy 8, so it's not that bad of a deal of a chromosome issue, but it was there, and so it was, you know, and so Dr. Garcia Manero, he's wonderful, and then was trying to get the blast down as low as he could, whereas the stem cell doctor, one thing I wish there was more of a meeting of the minds.
Yep.
What they felt like and what the leukemia department here feels like, because leukemia doctor kept on saying, let's go for, you know, let's get the blast as low as possible. I don't know if you ever thought that, will guys ever get the chromosomal, to cure the chromosomal?
Just sometimes. Yep. Not always.
I was on actually a study with Bisaccharides and Percenostat.
Oh, okay.
A study.
So it was a Vidaza plus minus Presentostat.
Yeah.
So some people, 50% of people got Presentostat, and some people were getting placebo, and it was completely blinded. So
Right. Treating
physicians and patients didn't know what they were getting.
But that was another reason why I chose this facility, because if I had stayed at the other hospital in the med center, then I would have just got Vidaza. But that hospital was also recommending, let's go as quickly as possible, let's go to the stem cell transplant, because they want to be really healthy. But on the other hand here, we were kind of in a stall pattern of doing the chemo on that month. And yet I had my stem cell doctor here, which is, you know, on the same floor, saying, let's go. We're ready to go. We got your, you know, we found your match. I had four. If y'all haven't had a stem cell transplant, just to get a match, a donor, because none of my relatives were matches, or my siblings. And so it's something to just find a match. And I had four of them, luckily, that were 10 matches. So I was very, very fortunate. And the first one had to back out the week before. So I was very, very fortunate to have another one, backup one, to do this stem cell transplant. And anyway, once we acquired that, the stem cell team was ready to go to do it. And also, I think it was also because my blast got below 10%. They went from 12 to 8.
8.
Yeah. Well, they ended up at 4, but they were still at 8.
I told them.
I know. I get into more details. So anyway, there's just so many things to look at. Once they got below 10, I think the stem cell team was ready to go, and the doctor here was still wanting to get lower because he felt like the outcome would be better. And so that was a big thing. I was like, okay, well, we don't know, you know what.
So a couple comments about that experience. One is MD Anderson is fairly unique in kind of the places that treat MDS. There's a couple other places, Seattle, Sloan Kettering, where there's leukemia teams and there's transplant teams. A lot of institutions, the leukemia physician is the transplanter.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually a unique scenario at a few of the top largest centers where you have that kind of interplay between the leukemia doctor and the transplant doctor, which I think honestly is helpful because you have two experts. You know, one's a transplant expert and one's a leukemia expert, really. But you're right. There's always a... We talk about risk and benefits a lot with MDS, right? And so certainly a transplant has a better chance of working the less disease you have at the time of your transplant, right? Because you're focusing on this new immune system of someone else coming in and taking over, and the more disease you have, the harder it is for that to happen. Right. Right? So you want a lower burden of MDS at the time of the transplant if you're, you know, if you're supposed to go for a transplant. But then there's also the more time that passes, the more cycles of therapy you get, the more times that, you know, your counts might have done this, the higher chance that you're at risk of some infection or complication, and you might lose the opportunity to get to the transplant you need. So since, you know, the transplanters, if they have the transplant, they're ready, and they don't want something to happen that can prevent you from getting to the transplant. You know, and we're saying, well, we know it's going to be a little bit better, you know, but what's a little bit better? You know, and that's the population that we talk about, not the individual persons.
Mm-hmm. So I was saying that a little bit better thing, and of course, the leukemia doctor wanted me to get better. The transplant doctor is saying it doesn't matter what we give you during that stem cell transplant. It's going to wipe out all the cancer cells and your own good cells anyway, so you're good enough.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yes.
And also, I was going to be on an experiment, another
protocol
that was for graft-versus-host disease, and that would have also helped. But I had to get off that point and get out of that because my cells weren't growing. But anyway, for my donor cells were growing. So, but anyway, so that's.
I'm going to interrupt for 1 second just to show on the board. So when people are talking about the blast percentages and the cytogenetics, so the IPSS is the most common tool. There's a revised one now that a lot of people use, but the easiest one, just to kind of know in the back of your head, is the IPSS. So the
three things that have the most impact on your MDS is the percentage of blown blasts, which, you know, is what you were talking about here. You were somewhere in this range. Right, you're 12%, I think, initially. The karyotype, which are the chromosome changes. And so down here it defines good is normal, minus Y, isolated deletion 5Q or a 20Q, intermediate is anything else except for poor, which has, you know, more than three changes, or chromosome 7. Okay, so that's the chromosome risk factors. And then cytopenias, meaning of those three cell lines that we talked about, do you have just one cell line that's affected, like just your platelet counts, which it sounds like you were maybe at the beginning, you know, just an isolated platelet, mm-hmm. or is it, you know, two or three cell lines? The white cells and the red cells and the platelets are all lower than they should be. And then you add these scores together, you know, you add it together, and then you get this total score, and that defines, you know, whether you're low risk, intermediate one, intermediate two, or high, with the median survival, but these are patients that were not treated. So the important thing to know when you're looking at these percentages and these survival times of the IPSS score, this is if you don't receive treatment. And so treatment in the modern area with Vidaza and decitabine and lenalidomide and all these things impact this favorably, and that's not something that a lot of patients actually realize. So very important that you realize that survival is better for all of us than
so
the IPSS score.
The median age of survival, is that for people you're saying they didn't get any, not even the...
Correct. These were all people that were monitored over time with zero treatment.
That's the first time I've heard that. So he gave us the IPSS and never really mentioned that he was getting the best and he's working at an increase.
Yes, that's the whole point, right? That's the whole point of treating with Vidaza, you know, improve counts.
Yeah. I assume that the life expectancy was that with treatment.
So are you upset with treatment?
Well, so that's
because you've got 10 years so far.
Yeah.
You know, like all statistics, I've got data on charts that show all of this and everything else. But in my case, my blast counts 8 years apart from a bone marrow have been two. Mm-hmm. And I had the deletion 5Q from 2004 and 2012. Yet I think my question to you would be, what causes the bone marrow to change? Because I didn't see any change between those 7 or 8 years, and now I see a change. So is it the treatments that are impacting the bone marrow to change, or is it just time?
So the question is, you had a kind of stable, low-risk MDS.
I've had a life count of two ever since the inception.
And then all of a sudden, things...
Well, I don't know. The last count's probably still two.
Okay.
Or lower. But other things have changed.
Okay.
Okay, when he's done. Because I've had like three bone... I just had one Thursday. Bone marrow and a biopsy Thursday.
Okay.
So that he can go over them with me again.
Right.
See where we
usually
are.
Usually, there are... So cancer, any cancer, is genetic changes that happen over time. Right? There are these mutations or... site or chromosome changes or some sort of abnormalities that happen, and if it starts as, you know, one of the normal stem cells in your bone marrow, those what are called the hematopoietic stem cells that are in charge of making the white cells, the red cells, and the platelets, and then it requires a change that makes it work better than the others, right? It can replicate faster or it's stronger, it outlives the others, right? So it has this growth advantage. So you have these cells in your bone marrow that are functioning just a little bit better, and it's actually not cancer again, right? But then maybe one of those ones gets another genetic change in an area that makes it outgrow even faster, right? So then this clone starts going more, and at some point, you know, an average MDS patient has like 6 to 8 genetic changes. And so you acquire these changes in these cells over time, and then at some point it becomes a kid. So my suspicion for you is that it was kind of, there was this abnormal population that some additional hit happened, whether it was you acquired another chromosome change or another genetic mutation, and that's why we always repeat bone marrow here, because we have a lot of tests to look at the different kind of mutations, genetic changes that can happen to try to get a sense of, you know, what the specific abnormalities in your MDS are. So just to show you
kind of what I'm talking about. I have it on. This is what I have. So this is all within the past 10 years that we've identified all these different genetic changes. And so MDS, as an average person, has like 6 mutations. And so we're realizing that, you know, there are these genes, some of which we know a lot about, some of which we don't really know much about at all, are abnormal, and that, you know, the combination of different things that happen kind of tell us a little bit about the biology of MDS, but it's just now starting to impact treatment decisions. So we now have, it's on the bottom, IDH1-2, we have IDH inhibitors that have just hit clinical trials, they've been developed. FLT3 is at the bottom, we have FLT3 inhibitors, those tend to be happening. But so to answer your question a little bit, I don't know your specific story, but certainly something has happened. If your disease is changing, it's most likely maybe one of these new alterations.
Yeah, it probably has.
Yeah.
I do recall some changes, but specifics I can't recall.
And so, you know, when you're thinking about this, is this me? Okay. You know, your disease probably was at a low risk for a while with your low platelet count. And then, you know, you said you developed that trisomy 8. You know, that's a marker that your disease is becoming more aggressive. Plus the blast going up, right?
Because I don't think the blast, there were blasts at first blood marrow biopsy, but
certainly that would have been.
But it should have been done more often. There should have been more often in that 3-year period, according to the first doctor.
Yeah.
I mean, the one that diagnosed me, it sounded like that because that's a risk, that it should have been monitored.
We typically monitor, you know, and there's actually no great evidence, but we typically monitor people with counts every so often when they're low risk, like every 3 months or so, with a bone marrow every 6 months or so, 6 months a year, to see if there's any changes. But that's practice, that's not evidence based, that's what I do.
We are about coming here for our treatment. So up until April, we lived in a little town called Trinity. It has 2 stoplights and a grocery store. And in April, we moved to Huntsville, and we are now 5 minutes from a hospital as opposed to 25 minutes. But I'd like Danny to tell a story, because I tend to talk a lot. And I retired from one career and then went to nursing school, and I'm a registered nurse. I tend to
Well, first, thanks for being here and showing us a little bit more about what's going on. What is the average hemoglobin when somebody's first diagnosed with this?
A normal hemoglobin of an average person is somewhere between like 13 to 16 or so. So that's normal. And most people with MDS, when they're diagnosed, are quite a bit lower. It's probably on the order of like 8 to 10. Some people are diagnosed, it just depends, because again, remember, MDS is a constellation of a lot of different diseases, really, a lot of different kind of genetic changes. There's different types of MDS. Some people are diagnosed because they are so short of breath that they can't get from, you know, one side of their house to the other. They go into the hospital and they have a hemoglobin of 4 because they, you know, haven't realized that it's been a very slowly progressive thing over probably 6 months. And we see that, you know, fairly frequently.
Yeah, I was thinking that from the head for quite a while.
Yeah.
Right. Tired, weak.
Yep.
And,
yeah, we hear that a lot.
Put up with that for a long time, you know. Mm-hmm. And, are you a golfer?
Pardon?
Are you a golfer?
Don't play golf.
Yeah. I was.
Yeah, I was too.
Pretty good at it too, but I, after a couple of surgeries, I quit.
Yeah, that's where I'm at now, trying to decide. I was a golf pro and in the golf business my whole life.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that's where we first figured out something was wrong. New Year's Eve, I guess it was
2011.
Yeah. New Year's Eve, 2 years ago, I was playing with some guys at Elkins Lake.
Yeah.
And I was playing good. We had about 5 points and we all get together. But that particular day, I know when if I hit it down a hill and land in a bunker or something, that I had a hard time climbing from the bunker back into the car. So I could stand still and hit a golf ball, but after that it was tough. So I got around to number 12 and I told I was quarter over par at the time. I told guys that I'm going to have to go in and understand. One of the guys said, let me call my wife. She's a nurse. And let her come out here and check all your vital signs. And sure. She came out on the next train and checked everything. And she said, you need to get to the doctor. I said, everything's out of whack. So this was on Friday. I'm not going to get too many doctors on Saturday morning that you know, so I waited till Monday morning and called them. No, I waited.
You can get into the doctor.
I called them, and they said the earliest recognition would be Thursday of next week. So I said, okay. So it'd be the latest appointment we got, so it'd be about 5 o'clock. Get over there and tell you what happened. And this doctor has a real bad reputation. Yeah. You go in there and he's telling you how to go, he'll give you a shot or a pill and send you home. That's about all he's good for. So he was going to try that on me. So told him what happened and he said, well, it sounds like we need to do some blood work. So then we went in and took some. Much blood. Then we go home and we'll call you when we get some medicine back. Mm-hmm. So it was about 7 o'clock. And, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that evening they started getting some of the death results back. Mm-hmm. And she said you had a 4.8.
Hemoglobin.
Yeah.
Actually, on the blood test, it was a 5 on that day. He didn't call us that it was in the morning that he ran in. He didn't call us that afternoon with a credit low. He called called the next day and said, you can continue taking B12 or iron, it was a 5.6 at that time, or you can get a blood transfusion. And I'm like, well, B12 and the iron, he didn't tell us the numbers. He just said it was low. And I said, well, you know, we've been taking the B12 and iron for months. That's not going to work. So we couldn't get a hold of his office, so we just showed up because it's right next to a hospital in the Trinity.
Well, they set it up, and it'll give me two or three years.
You probably felt quite a bit better, huh?
So we go in and get set up for the 2 units, and the nurse got the board. She's looking at me. She says, you're a 4.8.
By the time we got into this.
Yeah, that's what that says. So most people just come in on the stretcher and report that.
It's true. Now, what that means is this was a very slow process over time. Because if your body goes from a normal count of 15 to 4, kind of if you were to bleed or if that was to happen over like a week or two, your body wouldn't be able to tolerate that. You know, your circulatory system would collapse. So it must have been a very slow process that allowed your body to kind of.
Now that I look back,
yeah.
I feel like I've had this or the symptoms for years.
Probably.
And you didn't realize it, knowing that your body was just kind of adjusting to your symptoms that you were feeling when you're like, oh, I feel tired, let me take a nap.
Yeah. I didn't want to go get a physical or nothing. I just
wanted to
go wake up.
Oh, no.
What happens to it over time is your body gets accustomed to a lower level of hemoglobin. In other words, you can have MDS and have a 12 count. And a normal adult male has 14 to 18 and female 13 to 16. And you can operate on 12. And if you're lower, and it takes you another year to get down to 11, and you maintain a pretty stable 11 number, your body gets accustomed to that. Because most of us that have, and most of the people I know here, run counts in the nines.
Right.
And you can operate pretty good on nines. You get a little out of breath if you walk too fast or you exert yourself.
Everyone has different thresholds. Some people, we don't transfuse until their hemoglobin drops below 7 because they function just fine at that level. Some people it's 8, some people it's 9. So it's.
I came in at 5.4 one time because I was losing blood from another reason.
Yeah.
And they rushed me from the clinic to ER. I mean, I had two guys. We were on a racetrack.
I didn't tell you to take me 12.
Yeah, same thing. Well, I was at home. I couldn't move. I had a friend come over whose wife was on oxygen.
Yeah.
And he came over and gave me oxygen and they stuck my finger in. I think we couldn't get zero on it, you know.
Yeah.
So it was scary, really. But when you're at 4.8, you know, what I worried about is if you don't have enough blood going to your brain, it's going to affect the cells in your brain. So 4 and 5 are a pretty low count.
Yeah. But I didn't know. But I'm going in and get the blood.
Yeah.
And the nurse looks at me and said, you shouldn't be walking. But I've been getting bad like that for quite a while.
Yeah.
So we go in and get the blood. This was in January. And it was cold outside. And she said, doctor said, go home. No, you shouldn't go home. You should stay here overnight. It was 2 o'clock in the morning then. And let us set you up for 2 or 3 more units and then we'll see what it comes up to. And we call the doctor, and the doctor says, send him home and get him to call me next week. And we're going out to the car, and the nurse runs out there before I drove off. And she said, look, he said, I know I'm his nurse. Have been for a long time, but I'm going to tell you right now, listen to me, go get you another doctor right now.
Huh? Nurse. You know, that speaks for what exactly happened is that you had a really good advocate, okay, thinking for you, additional to your wife, thinking, what the heck is going on? And this does not make sense. I think that's important. I think we all need advocates in our lives. You have him, plus other caregivers and other professionals in it, so, and you have, you're going to be the
my vote is 3.7. And I think it's a golfer syndrome, because as long as he can play golf, it's fine. But when it's starting getting more difficult for him to get out of the bunkers and walk to the green, and his eye breath, he couldn't finish 18 holes, something must be wrong.
It must be, because I had just learned golf.
It's interesting because this is Texas, so I have to reflect this back next time I, you know, go to another patient forum, because each place they speak in different ways of identifying their symptoms.
Colorado is the number of fields that
you
use.
Yeah.
I'm Leslie Colburn, and I've had MDS probably since 1998. I had a breast cut, and I can pinpoint that because I had a breast biopsy in 1997, and all the pre-operative was okay. In 1998, when the doctor checked my blood work, I was anemic. And so we started off with every kind of iron known to man, including liquid iron, which is the vilest stuff in the world. You take it by the teaspoonful, because if you mix it with water, it still tastes terrible. It still tastes as bad as the concentrated stuff. So, but and it took them about till 2002 before I had a diagnosis. At the time, I was working as a school business administrator, which is a pretty high pressure, lots of balls in the air. By 2002, about the time I was diagnosed, I just couldn't do that job anymore, and I elected to retire from disability. Let's see, my hemoglobin was running around 8 or 10. I chose my original, I'm a medical technologist in the hospital laboratory worker by training undergrad, and I wanted to stay transfusion free as long as I could, because I was aware of antibodies and transmission. That was just about the time that they had diagnosed, that they had figured the West Nile virus was being transmitted by blood transfusions and all kinds of other stuff. So I elected to stay away from the blood transfusions. I then went home to New Jersey to take care of my parents, who were aging. When my mom passed away in 2005, I said, I can no longer handle my life at hemoglobin of 8. I just cannot do this anymore. So I like to have transfusions. At that point, the doctor who I was dealing with, who was also the hematologist that I was dealing with in Philly, at Penn, said, okay, now you're starting to need treatment. Now we're going to start looking at things. I do have an MGUS, which is a monoclonal gammopathy of limited significance, which is kind of like, it's a possibility that it's the baby myeloma, but it may not be. But when they did the bone marrow aspiration before they started treatment, I did have 20% blast cells. So the treatment of choice at that point was Spilimumab, because at that point, that was 2005, that was just when Revlimid had been introduced. It was not available everywhere, and it was much more expensive than Spilimumab. I was on
thalidomide for 3.5 years until just after I moved up here. The reasons for wanting to go off with thalidomide was that I was having trouble getting out of my own way. It's a depressant, so it's, you know, I was spending a couple, even though I took it in the evening, I was having trouble getting out of my own way. And it really takes a lot out of me physically. Also, I decided I wanted to go to the gym, and when they did some testing on balance and that sort of thing at the gym, and I finally went to the neurologist, I had lost like 75% of my sensory innervation in my feet and my lower legs.
Those just cause neuropathy in some people.
Yes.
So no missing leg loss.
Yeah. So at that point in 2008, I went on Revlimid, which has been, again, the second miracle drug. My last transfusion was in October 2005. I started the thalidomide in September 2005.
That's great.
So, I'm running 10, 11 in COVID. I don't have any 5q- or any of the things that would normally predict that it would work. And the thalidomide was an experiment to start with. And it was mainly because I also had the MGUS, and they wanted to start to control those abnormal proteins that the plasma cells were putting out. The last bone marrow that I had, which was about 6 years ago, did not show any plasma cells. I have a hyperplastic marrow, which means that they can do the biopsy take a piece of bone, that's not a problem. But pulling the aspirate out is like pulling cement through the tube. You know, the aspirate and cement through there. So that's normally a tough one to get. I have had the karyotype done a couple times. The last time was in Philly, and the guy that found Philadelphia chromosome was the guy whose lab was the one that just retired. So, that's a good thing. So, and I've been here.
I actually trained at that. Peter also goes to all of the seminars and he's retired.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
That reporter?
Yeah.
Okay.
Reporter.
Yeah. He was my doctor. So, yeah. And I've also done. Good at name dropping. I saw Dr. Garcia Manero when I moved down there when I chose to move down here. But he's shipped me off to Dr. Alexanian because of the thalidomide and the MGUS and all that stuff. I also was part of a study that's lost its funding in Tampa. Just looking at long-term, what people with MDS look like over the long term. And unfortunately, that's not active anymore, I guess. So, but I used to go over there, visit my sister.
Great.
And thanks for the course.
All right, well, I apologize. So it's about 10 minutes after the hour. Go ahead, Jay. I have to leave. But my email, I'm going to put back up for a minute or two. I am happy to take any questions if anyone has any. And it was really lovely for the session. So I haven't done too much of these patient forums. This was really nice. So thank you all.
Do you guys want to stretch your legs a little bit for 5 minutes? Or do you have any last minute questions for Dr. Gennaro?
How long have you been here? You're an MD?
Almost 3 years. Relatively new recruits
for this. Yes. Bone marrow biopsy is something that patients do not look forward to.
Correct.
Good reason. I read frequently that they're doing tests now, that at some point in the future they're thinking they may not be able to have to do
those?
It depends on the type of bone marrow problem that you have. If you have, for instance, CML, which is characterized by that 922 translocation, we can test that in the peripheral blood using molecular tests. So those patients no longer, you know, you can be having your surveillance over time with blood. So yes, at some point there's the hope that that will be an option. We can do a lot of the testing through peripheral blood. We're not anywhere close to that for the majority at this point in time. A lot of patients have very traumatic bone marrow experiences when they come to MD Anderson or an institution where they do a lot of bone marrows, and it's much more of a procedure that the proceduralists that do it are very familiar with, and they tend to be, you know, you can never promise anything, but in general, people tolerate bone marrows much better at places that is familiar with bone marrows.
And they're much more successful, too.
Right. And we do offer kind of sedation. We have different levels. We have anxiolysis, which means we give people medicine and put them into a little loopy twilight sleep for people who really have trouble tolerating it. And then in certain situations, you can actually knock people out to, you know, sedation for bone marrows if they need it. So that is always, you can always figure out a way to make it not so distressing for patients.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so let's start for a few minutes and then come back. It's 11:15, maybe at 11:25. Give you guys like 5-10 minutes to stretch. I do want to tell you that I unfortunately have to end this forum a little bit earlier only because we all have to catch a flight at 3:30, 3:40. So I just want to make sure we get there on time. So is it okay if we finish around 1:30 for you guys? Is that okay? Okay. And we'll have lunch at 12-ish, so we can sit and chat and just, you know, get to know each other and stuff. So how about 5 minutes stretch, bathroom break, and then come back, and then I can do my spiel on my presentation, and then we can chat. Okay? All right.
I'm from Jersey, so I grew up in Jersey.
What part?
Cranberry.
Oh, okay, yes, I like Cranberry.
Yeah, that area. My